And welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. Today is Wednesday, December 4th, 2019. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today for the entire hour is poet Stephen Dunn. Stephen is the author of 19 poetry collections and was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry for Different Hours in 2001. He received the Academy Award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, fellowships from the Guggenheim and the Rockefeller Foundations, 3 NEA Creative Writing Fellowships, and many, many other awards. His work draws on mortality and morality and is wry and wide-reaching, and he has the ability to talk about human nature with honesty and restraint. And I first discovered his poetry around 1980 when I lived in San Francisco and rode Muni everywhere. And there was at the time, there was a poetry on the buses program there with ads, the ads atop windows, those placards that kind of stretch along the windows of a bus, if you've been on a bus lately. And there was a poem by him. I wish I could remember the actual poem, but that's when I became an immediate fan. Stephen was last on the program February of 2017. That show is on the archive at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. And I think he was on in 2001 as well for Different Hours, and that show should be there too. He's back today with his new collection of poems. It's called Pagan Virtues. Let's bring him on. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you here again. I'm so happy to talk with you about this collection. You wouldn't happen to remember the poem back on the bus.
There were a few of them that were maybe one called Backyard is possible.
Backyard, okay, I'm going to look it up because, I remember right then, I don't think I'd ever seen anything by you, and there it was, and there I was. When you were last on, I remember we talked about how you found your way to poetry, and I believe it was via a trip to Spain, and I think you were a copywriter for Nabisco, for a major company, and you went away. And could you talk about that, how you found your way to poetry?
Well, it was... I wasn't a copywriter. I wrote copy for an in-house brochure.
Okay.
For Nabisco. But it scared me. I kept on doing it so well and getting promoted that I quit and went to Spain to write a novel, and wrote a poor novel. But it was full of language, and as a result of that failure, really, I saw that I should be writing poetry. And my friend Sam came over. He was the only literary person I knew. Then he came to visit and conferred that poetry was pretty good. And that's how I think if he had said otherwise, I might not have written anything.
Do you ever, have you ever excerpted anything from that novel and made it a poem?
I threw that novel away.
In Spain?
Yeah, it didn't deserve to be seen.
That's interesting. I want to talk about Pagan Virtues. There's a lot to talk about here. The first thing that caught me about the collection was the title. And I wondered if the title, at what point did the title come? I know there's a title poem, Pagan Virtues, that I'd like to hear you read in a little bit. But I think titles to collections, titles to poems are interesting, but then titles to collections always intrigue me. How did this one come about?
I don't remember exactly. I remember it dawned on me and I liked it and wrote a poem based on it, which I'll read when you want me to.
Yeah, I would love that.
And it was good enough to be the title poem, I thought. And it reaches or extends into the other poems in the book.
Okay.
Pagan Virtues. If you have them, your day will overflow with options. You can re-examine everything that smells of dogma or the forbidden. Tip your hat to the great poem that is the body. Maybe even uphold the beautiful by renouncing the pretty. Appearance helps me in trouble on holidays, which are holy days for others, but for you are days off, a chance to exercise your pleasures, perhaps speculate why prayer never seems to reach its destination. Tell your church-going friends that you're more like a justice of the peace than a witch or a warlock. Someone trying with the help of the best has been written instead, without aid from the cloudy above. Divine what's evil, investigate what's good. Attempt to live in a world a person from another world might want to muck around in. Raise children. Guide them to discover for themselves what it means to be a citizen.
Do you remember the trigger for this poem?
Don't. Most of my poems these days originate from language and not from experience, though they embrace experience in a way, but very rarely these days am I writing poems about things that happened to me, worthy enough to bear the title, all I know.
Well, that sort of works into something I've been curious about when a poet has been writing for a while and has, I don't know if publishing matters. I suppose it does, but I'm just curious. I mean, you began publishing, I think, in 1971. And I, you know, you just said now, you know, how poems come to you. But I'm curious if there are other ways that your work has changed and how it's also remained the same.
I like now to let the next line find itself always, not necessarily based on experience, whether it cooperates linguistically with the other language that preceded it. And then I work my way down the page and I find out what I'm doing, or with luck I find out what I'm doing, sometimes without luck. If you're working non-experientially, letting language dictate the next moment. You're flying for a while, and the danger becomes when you do discover what you're doing, and you lose verve, perhaps. So I'm very conscious of when I find myself knowing what I'm doing, to keep the poem alive by discovering.
So, in terms of revising then Pagan Virtues, I mean, you've been writing a long time and you have all these collections and so I'm imagining that it becomes easier, that there isn't the same sort of process of revision as maybe in the early days. Is that so?
No, I think I revise more than ever.
Really?
I never get things on the first try. I have my wife and good friend, Larry Robb, who always keep me honest by telling me that the poem I have is a failure in certain ways, where it's not living up to the best language that I've already used. And I'm constantly exchanging these poems with him and her. And then they turn out a little better, I think.
Do you ever throw them out? Do you ever say, you know, this just isn't worth saving. I can't save this one.
I think my ratio of success is a little higher now. If I stay with a poem longer than two stanzas, say, I'm likely to finish it.
What about, there's another one that was intriguing because it, you know, you use Chekhov and you use the Americans, and it's sort of a nod to pop culture in a way. I think it's on 49. It's as if Chekhov had written it.
That's 49.
Yeah, could you read that one?
We can talk about that. Yeah, I forgot to find it. But On page 49.
Yeah.
Give me another page, where it might be.
Pardon me?
Not on page 40. I found it. It's on 47. Had you seen The Americans?
Oh, yeah. I saw all seasons, and so that's why I was especially intrigued by this one.
Yeah, I was very captivated by it and found myself disliking and strangely admiring these two people.
Mm-hmm.
But they're awful people.
Yes, they are awful people.
But the Chekhov could have done them just right. Here's the poem.
Okay.
Chekhov had written it. Chekhov with his cold eye reminded us there's no escaping what we've done, and therefore who we would be. Let me start again. Chekhov with his cold eye would have reminded us there's no escaping what we've done, and therefore who we would become. High up on a hill, overlooking a brightly lit Moscow, Philip and Elizabeth aren't sure who we are, how much disappointment awaits. Training to be Americans, they've been found out. And here they are in the sad country they spied and murdered for. Now we hear them speak reassuring lies to each other. Their children will be okay, the world, the future. They believe everything they've done has been some larger good. As if Chekhov had written it, sense of inevitability mixes with sense of doom. Yet we feel a terrible tenderness toward each of them. We've often despised. It's 1988. In a year the wall will come down. There's no escaping what we've allowed ourselves to imagine.
Yeah, I love that. I love this poem. Talk about writing this. I mean, obviously it's after, you know, all the seasons are over. And I remember that image of these two sitting there, too. But talk a little bit about how this poem came to you.
Well, it's an unusual poem for the book in that it's based on something that is literal, that has clearly preceded the poem. And I just wanted to be true to it. And I was very moved by the whole thing. And that is especially thinking of Chekhov with his truly cold eye that's full of compassion also. How he would have handled such a poem, such a situation. Not a very good explanation, but...
Yeah. Yeah, it's wonderful. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Stephen Dunn, and we're talking about his new collection, Pagan Virtues, published by Norton. I was curious about that, about when I read that, you know, because a lot of your poems sound very autobiographical, and obviously, we should not assume that, but talk about that, about, you know, using an experience to then trigger a poem and why you might be in compositional trouble if you don't distort the original experience.
Say that again?
What you said in that interview about distorting, that if you don't distort the original experience,
yes,
of, whatever you're writing about, that you may be in compositional trouble.
Yes.
And I wondered about that, and if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Well, I've been accused a lot lately of being an honest poet, and I think honesty is an achievement. It's something hard won. You have to know yourself quite well to be honest. But I think I'm in the illusion business. I'm creating illusions of the truth, of what happened. And I love when people think it's true. I want them to think it's true. It all happened. It means I've been successful. But I rarely am writing out of, say, the way I did the Americans poem.
Mm-hmm.
Writing out of that impulse.
So
more likely, I start with a sentence that I like or have stolen and screw it up a little bit, and then go from there and find things that hold up.
Hmm. So where does persona enter into things then? I mean, are you thinking, you know, I'm going to write from this particular point of view or persona, or are you just, or do you not even go there? Do you just go, you know what, I'm going to take this seed, this little bit, and turn this into something, and persona, you know, isn't a part of it?
I don't think in terms of persona, but they are mostly persona poems. The Inheritance, for example, on page 42, nothing in that poem ever happened to me, but things I'm aware of things like that that happened to others.
Would you read that one?
Yeah. I'll try. It's a little bit long for my voice.
Okay.
I'll try. The Inheritance. You shouldn't be surprised that the place you always sought and now have been given carries with it a certain disappointment. Here you are, finally inside, and not a friend in sight. The only gaiety that exists is the gaiety you brought with you, and how little you had to bring. The bougainvillea outside your front window, like the gardener himself, has the look of something that wants constant praise. And the exposed wooden beams, once the main attraction, now feel pretentious, fit for someone other than you. But it's yours now, and you suspect you'll be known by the paintings you hang, the books you shelve, and no doubt your need to speak about the wallpaper as if it weren't your fault. Perhaps that's why, wherever you go these days, vanity has followed you like a clownish dog. You're thinking that with a house like this, you should throw a big party and invite a Nick Carraway and ask him to bring your dream girl. And would he please also referee the uncertainties of the night? You're thinking that some fictional characters can be better friends than real friends can ever be. For weeks now, your dreams have been offering you their fractured truths. You don't know how to inhabit them yet, and it might cost another fortune to find out. Why not just try to settle in, take your place, however undeserved, among the fortunate? Why not trust that almost anyone, even in his own house, is a troubled guest?
Hmm. So, who is the you that you're talking to?
I have no idea.
Uh-huh.
As in the Mrs. Cavendish poems,
yes,
in this book, I had no idea who was speaking to Mrs. Cavendish and who she was. I made it up as I developed the poems. I didn't always work that way, but the last maybe 10 years I've mostly been working this way.
So with the
happy when the next line feels true and yet and discovered at the same time.
Yeah. So when the Inheritance, when you started writing the Inheritance, did it come out in one fell swoop? I mean, do you work on poems in parts? I mean, might you write a few lines and say, you know, let's see if anything comes tomorrow?
Or I stayed with it. But I'm sure it went through many versions. I send my papers each year to Hofstra University, who has them. And I send my, right about this time of the year, I start going through my drafts. I probably have about 40 drafts of this poem.
Mm. So you'll save them all?
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you consider a draft a new draft, even if you tweak a few words? Is that a new draft?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah? Okay.
But mostly it's how the poem finds out what is central in it and works off of that and toward it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember exactly how this one began. I have no idea, in fact.
So, you know, I'm curious about the Mrs. Cavendish, the Mrs. Cavendish poems, part four of the collection. Talk about all of these. Talk about the idea behind writing these series of poems.
It's the most unusual way poems come about for me. I started it with, I think, the poem about secrecy, which is now in the middle of the section. And the more I started to invent this Mrs. Cavendish, the more it became, the more I started to understand her. I never really tried to understand the guy who was writing to her. Of course, part of him is me, I suspect. It's very unusual how this one came about. I can't tell you much about it, except it's like, a novel with a lot of scenes left out.
And in this section, there is a couplet, and I think the only couplet in the collection of poems, The Keeper of Limits.
What page is that on?
Well, it's on my 89, so maybe it's on your 87.
Okay.
Because I think I have an advanced review copy, and I think our pages are off a bit. But
hold on one second.
And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm with Stephen Dunn. We're talking about pagan virtues. Okay.
It's not really a couplet, right? It's a statement that she makes.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to find it again.
Yeah, it's on my 89, so it would be on your 87 or your 91. I'm not sure how we're... how our pages are comparing here, but...
Read it to me, if you will.
Okay. The Keeper of Limits. She would often seek that splendid rush, not caring that it would soon subside. After all, the issue was joy. She knew it was never meant to last. Disappointment was always nearby. She couldn't make it disappear or entirely ignore it. But once she discovered the freedoms within boundaries, it was like living with a difficult but fair father, something to push against while you found your own way. Mrs. Cavendish, I said, I'm on your side. Like you, I abhor the pretty good, the okay, those enemies of wonderment. I want everything that's mine, she said, to rise, be contained, spill over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's 87 in my book.
Okay.
And it was originally published as a chapbook with Sarah Band, and the title of the chapbook was The Keeper of Limits. You wrote it that late, but it seemed like a decent enough beginning. The Keeper of Limits, the Mrs. Cavendish poems. And why this is written in couplets, I don't know. I have no idea. It seems to want to be in couplets.
Well, and that, of course, that brings up another question for me, and that is, should beginning poets learn traditional forms first? Should poets learn about the villanelle, learn about the couplet, learn about, you know, all the different forms? Or how do you teach poetry? How do you start with poets?
I don't have them begin with traditional forms, but in the course of working with a poet, I would hope that they would try everything. To work with couplets is almost as naked as working with one-line stanzas. They have to have a certain integrity. They seem that they draw attention to themselves. They're all alone out there. So it puts some greater pressure on the poet to make them hold up. But I eventually, if I'm working with a student for longer than a semester, I want that student to try every form possible. Just like a good carpenter knowing his tools.
Do you ever find sort of like similar to perhaps when you were in Spain and writing a novel that you decided ultimately did not work? Do you ever see a writer or work with a writer and have a feeling like maybe you're not a poet, maybe you're a novelist, maybe you're an essayist?
Sure.
I mean, are those, or is sort of, I guess what I'm asking is, can a writer, does a writer decide what form they are best suited to, or does, or is it something else? You know, is it just something innate, the way you?
It's really not innate. I think it's very much practice and trying out different things. Certainly, I've seen poets who should be working in prose rather than in poetry, and the prose poem is a nice little medium for them. Then. But no, I don't know. I think we want. I have poems. I wrote a villanelle the other day, which I have maybe three successful villanelles out of all these years, and I've never written a successful sestina. But I've tried, and I think probably the habit of trying to make things work in form, in a pre-existent form, puts a different pressure on you to make the line hold up. I like the pressure.
What about, you know, I've heard a writer, a novelist actually, say that she could never be a poet because she can't hear where to break the line. And yeah. I'm real curious about that. I mean, again, is enjambment or line breaks, is that something that you can teach, or is it something,
yes,
or is it like
so.
Music, where you know you either can hear it or you can't, and it's hard to teach someone to become a, you know, an accomplished musician, say.
Yeah, a lot of it is what your breath will allow you to. Where it says stop and where it says go. I can't read Whitman very well out loud because his lines are too long for my breath. I love Whitman. I can't read Ginsberg well. My in this poem, for example, she would often seek a splendid rush. It's about as long as I can go for a line before it asks to be broken.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are little tricks that I remember how in graduate school all of us were in love with James Wright's "The Blessing," I think it is, with a great line break at the end. I will break into blossom if I stepped out of myself. Line break, I would break into blossom. That was so wonderful. Ruined a lot of poems for me because I try to be that tricky all the time. And most of my lines break where, if I read the poem, if I get a long pause, for example, after the line break, it would make it seem false. It's a way of organizing your breath, I think. And my favorite line break is James Wright's on his poem to Franco and Eisenhower. Poem about Franco, he says, he promises all dark things will be hunted down. So you have the doubleness of the meaning. He promised all dark things is a great line about Franco. Be hunted down changes the meaning, allows for both meanings. And that's always a temptation. But if you try for the tricky line break all the time, you're going to fail.
Hmm. Well, I notice with your poems, your line breaks, the last word of your lines, they're all like they're either sensory or specific. You don't tend to end with sort of filler words, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine you're paying attention to that.
I'm very conscious of where to break. And I just rewrote a poem this morning. This really feels like a different poem because I broke the lines differently. But the general rule is don't break on a feminine ending.
On a what?
Feminine ending. I have to excuse that sexist language, which is part of poetry. A feminine ending is one that doesn't have a stressed syllable.
Hmm.
And if you end on a stressed syllable, it propels you better into the next line.
That's interesting. I haven't heard that. That's great. Now I'm looking at. Well, what about the year before the election? On I guess you're 21. Could you read that?
Yeah, let me find it. There was a time when all the poets, even before the election, there was a time when all the poets seemed to be dying, my favorites and a few I couldn't bear. I folded back everything I knew and everything I thought I knew. So I was a man living in a world of his own crazy postponements. The weather there was calm, then tempestuous, then calm again, and in a weather I felt at the mercy of. A good friend dropped out of my life without explanation, wouldn't answer my letters or phone calls. A woman wrote to me saying she was sorry. I had no idea who she was. Only a few of the now dead poets committed suicide or drank themselves into oblivion. Their deaths were blamed on natural causes. What could be stranger? A prolonged silence began. In the past, that might have meant an important conversation was about to occur. It had, I was told, but hardly any of us were ready to hear it.
Mm. Talk about this poem and how it came about.
That came about because I knew what I was doing for a while anyway, and all my friends seemed to be dying, and of natural causes, which was very strange, as I remember when I was starting out as a poet, and all my heroes died around 50, 52, 53.
Mm-hmm.
Theodore Rethke, James Wright, people like that, and they didn't die of natural causes. So that was the impetus for the poem to talk about that. And the title came last. I know that. And it came about because of how the poem ended. A prolonged silence began in the past. That might have meant an important conversation was about to occur. It had, I was told. Hardly any of us were ready to hear it. That seemed pertinent to the election. And that's all I know about that poem.
Mm-hmm. So in your revision process, will you ever move lines? You know, some lines that are at the end of a poem might become the beginning, or...
Always happens.
Yes. Interesting.
And that's because... When we begin our poems, we usually begin with our conventional minds. And it's likely that your discovery line, your best lines, will occur mid-poem.
Mm.
And I often start with, if I'm conscious of such things that day, I often start with that poem in the middle. the lines in the middle, which then give me something more imaginative to live up to.
Hmm. And do you count syllables? No. What about assembling poems? Like putting a collection together like this, are you looking to tell sort of a story overall so that the reader begins at one point and ends at another? Or how are you putting these poems together? How are you deciding how poems sit beside each other? And, you know.
I think anything I would say would be a half truth. This poem, I was pleased it was held together, bracketed rather, by a poem I wrote in 1999 and called A Postmortem Guide for My Eulogist in Advance. And then, and I actually believe in 1999, no male in my family had lived past 60, and I turned 60 then. And I wrote a poem I thought was pretty good. So here I was alive again. Alive, not again, but alive. And I wrote to my eulogist in advance again. And that poem concludes the book. So it's bracketed by two poems about mortality. And that interested me. And that Norton allowed me to publish the poem that I'd already written in 1999.
I noticed with that poem, there's a phrase, you who are one of them, say that I loved. And those words, you who are, that phrase I've seen in, I believe I've seen it in different poems of yours, you know, where you're talking to people, you're talking to friends, you're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
Are you conscious of that showing up in other places?
I'm not, no.
Because I think one of the poems, a really early poem of yours that I loved, where you were talking to friends who've moved, you know, far away. You want to rent a room in Chicago or somewhere and bring. There's a similar construction in that poem. And mm-hmm. I found that really interesting.
I do too, but I can't talk about it. I don't know anything about it.
So, you know, with poetry collections, with this poetry collection, do you have thoughts of or hopes of what a reader takes away, you know, closes the book and, you know, feels a certain way, thinks a certain way? Do you have any thoughts about that, what you want to leave the reader with after reading a collection?
I would hope that I would subvert their best ideas. Really. There's a poem that... in a review of this book in Booklist, a very positive review, but it annoyed me because the reviewer praised two lines that preceded one of the best lines in the poem, which he never mentioned. I have to find it.
And if you just tuned in, you're a little bit late, because we have just a few minutes left with Stephen Dunn. We're talking about Pagan Virtues. And this show, along with others, will be podcasts. If you go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing, when we podcast this show and all shows, you'll receive a little indication in your podcast file. Anyway.
Okay, it's a poem called An Education on 39 in my book.
Okay.
I won't read the whole thing. I'll read the last stanza.
All right.
It would be the semblance of what feels true. Sometimes, though, you'd find yourself making dazzling nonsense. Sometimes just plain good sense, which might seem like wisdom, though everyone agreed with it. And I was very pleased with those last two lines. That was the discovery of the poem. But he left those out. He liked the lines that preceded it. My editor tells me I should be happy for a good review anyway.
That's interesting, though, that you talk a little bit more about the discovery of the poem in the last two lines. What exactly are you talking about?
Well, the poem is about making a poem, making art. And sometimes, though, you find yourself making dazzling nonsense, sometimes just plain good sense. And then the lines go, which might seem like wisdom until everyone agreed with it. That's the problem of being thought of as an honest poet, and often as a wise poet. Whenever that happens, I try to subvert my own wisdom, if there is, it reads like wisdom.
So, you know, I want to talk about endings, too. You know, those last two lines that you loved and the reviewer didn't mention. Ending a poem, how much attention are you giving to the last line, the last word?
A lot. I really work on getting endings right. Though that comes out of a certain philosophical predisposition, I suppose. Merwin, for example, doesn't try to make his last line click in. He suggests a continuum of some sort. I like my last lines to click in, which means I found something. I found the thread of the poem and have pulled it through to so it becomes it has to be a discovery for me.
Was there a poem in this collection that was particularly difficult for you, whether in the writing, in the completion, and pulling it together?
Let me think about that. I don't know. Maybe the first poem, Close to Running Amok, which is very different. It's an Ars Poetica. And I had to get it exactly right. Let me try to read that to you.
Okay.
Close to Running Amok. They let me help set up tents. Clean up after the elephants. Anything they wanted me to do, I did. The sword swallower and the man who ate fire were finicky about their props. I made sure everything was in place. Kid, they said, if things aren't perfect, illusion won't work. I was content to observe, note how much of it was practice, attention to detail. Come mornings after bringing coffee to the barker, I go to the big tent where the aerialists were getting ready to make sure what was difficult looked easy. They rehearse falling and being saved. Mostly they practice swinging into the hands of their father. Hold on one second. Well, I can't get to the next page. Speaking of the hands of their father, who was an awful man, it says, but when he was in the air, he was perfect. I can't find it. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, you said Ars Poetica. Talk about that. I noticed the form.
Most of my poems are Ars Poetica these days. I think that's what happens after a while. You're aware that you're writing a poem about something, but you're also aware that you're suggesting how a poem should be written or how a poem can be written. In this one, one of the key lines is, kid, they said, if things aren't perfect, illusion won't work. And that's an Ars Poetica line, as is. I was content to observe, know how much of it was practiced, attention to detail. I think if you look at Wallace Stevens' later poems especially, almost all Ars Poeticas. They're always talking about something that is its own subject, but by inference, by extension, is about poetry writing.
Interesting. That's a new one for me. Thank you. And we are at the end of our time. I wish we had more time. Do you have any sort of last words for the poets listening, or the hopeful poets?
Well, I've been telling poets who ask me what they should be doing is that they should treat themselves as all artists do. A dancer, for example, needs to be limber. A musician needs to practice all the time. Everyone needs to practice all the time. Treat yourself as if you were an artist of a different kind. Too many poets think because they feel something, it's worthy. It's irrelevant as far as I'm concerned. To make something work is an achievement. Very careful achievement.
I love that. Thank you. And thank you for spending the entire hour.
Well, I wish my voice were better, but
I'm just delighted to have you here on the air with me. So thank you.
Thank you, Barbara.
So much.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That was Stephen Dunn. His book is Pagan Virtues. It along with all of his work, is worth taking time with. He's one of my favorite poets of all time. And it's been a pleasure. All of you out there, stay at your desk, whether you're at a standing desk or a sitting desk, and get your work done. And today's a good day to get back to it if you've been taking a break. We'll see you right here next week. Have a great week.